Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews. A chance to sit down with someone in the literary world. Today's guest is a little different. Not only is he an author, he's also one of the experts on Blog Talk Radio. My guest today is John Hansen, author of Your Show Will Go Live in 5 Seconds. And quite frankly, it's a book that should be required reading for anyone planning to become a radio host on Blog Talk Radio, or indeed any other radio platform. John, welcome to the program.
Simon, it's nice to talk to you today. How are you?
I'm doing great. What part of the universe are you in?
Well, just in a small town just outside of Ottawa, Canada. So north of the 49th parallel, but still not too far north to be enjoying Florida-like weather this summer.
That's great. I greatly enjoyed your book. Your show will go live in 5 seconds. In some ways, it mirrored my own wild journey into radio. But before we get into the book, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who is John Hansen?
Well, you know, I have to tell you, it's an interesting question because that has a story behind it. Who I am today is the fortunate radio host of a show that recently aired its 650th episode, a show that focuses on not just business and political stories and current events, but you know, even music industry. For example, last week I had the pleasure of interviewing Chuck Negron, who's the former lead singer of Three Dog Night, who through Kickstarter, which is a crowdfunding platform, has chosen to launch his album. So the show is very diversified, to be certain. But I also, parallel to that, have not only written this book, but I'm a ghostwriter. So I've written a number of books that you probably have already read, and you just don't know I wrote it. But that's the life of a ghostwriter, assuming the shadows of the background to see a story get out there. So that's what I do today. How I came here was a little bit of a different journey. Of course, aren't all of our journeys different, where I never, ever anticipated writing or being a show host. It's just that the circumstances brought me to this. So, you know, I guess that's who I am. How's that for a short answer?
That's great. how did you get interested in becoming a radio host?
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I started a blog back in May of 2007, and, you know, we built up a loyal following and consistently writing to the blog, and I came across, quite by accident, in early 2009, the Blog Talk Radio site. And, of course, when I think of radio, I have warm memories of it from when I was growing up, in the days that it was a piece of furniture that was central to the living room, which had four legs and crackling tubes. And I can remember Saturday nights while my parents sat in the chair and brother sat in the chair listening to a sporting event or a story on there. I would slide my head underneath the legs and I would get that and listen in. It was almost like your own surround sound to a certain degree. And so that's what really drew me to Blog Talk Radio, because I thought, gee, how do you capture that love of terrestrial radio or traditional radio in an internet format? And if you can, and you can host your own show, what a great way to bring the pages of the blog to life by getting the people about whom I'm writing or talking onto the show themselves. It just added another dimension, and that's really how it all started. And aired my first show on March 26, 2009, which was a 30-minute format, and just talked about what the show was going to be about and what we hoped to accomplish and what we hoped our audience or my audience would get from it. So that's really how it started. Very somewhat innocuous, somewhat humble, but certainly based upon a strong and pleasant memories of the old radio days.
I guess my story is somewhat similar. It was many years ago. I sat bolt upright in bed and informed my wife I was going to become a book reviewer. I think she poked me and grunted and then said, "That's nice, dear. Now go back to bed." But, yeah, I got invited to join a couple of BTR programs, and you know, being the guy that I am, I decided that, well, if other people can do it, I can too. So I just jumped in feet first. It was an adventure, to say the least. I survived, and then I started to think about it. And, John, there are many elements that go into having a successful program. And I'm sure that some of the listeners today are thinking about taking the plunge. But it's often easy to become overwhelmed and possibly discouraged. But I like to equate BTR as to using Microsoft Word. Yeah, in 15 minutes, I can show someone how to create a simple document. You know, or I can spend 2 weeks and I can show them how to do all of the exotic stuff. What is the bare minimum that someone needs to have to get started with Blog Talk Radio?
Well, you know, one of the things that is very interesting is, and like anything, it's a simple, not easy. The simple point is that with Blog Talk Radio, it is an intuitive platform. So, you know, what I'm saying is that you don't have to go through a great deal of training to get up and operational from the time you decide you want to do a show to when you actually air a show. So technically speaking, part of the magic of Blog Talk Radio is that it's a very user-friendly interface. On the other side, what goes into the program, and I use a term, and we all are familiar with it, called content is king. And what I'm really saying there is that you have to have a passion for subject matter about what you're going to be talking. You want to be able to give the audience, as well as your guests, the very best of what you have to offer, and that means understanding the subject matter, researching it properly, making it entertaining for the guests. I mean, one of the best compliments that I receive from guests are they say, you know, I've done 100 shows or I've done 1,000 shows, and you've asked me questions that have never been asked before, or you've caused me to look at something that I thought about this way and maybe consider it that way. That's something that, you know, you have to have a desire to bring to the table to make the show last and endure. So, you know, if you were to look at it, that's the more complex part of it. But even in that, if you're dealing with something about which you are passionate, you're going to have a natural proclivity or ability towards being able to talk about that. I mean, you go to any dinner party, Simon, or any outing where people are gathered, and you know, you ask them about themselves or ask them about what they enjoy doing. There's no nervousness. There's no hesitation. They talk about it freely and seem to be very, very well informed about it. And I think that's really the key part of it, is you've got to marry that passion within the discipline to do the research, to try to bring to the airwaves, the virtual airwaves, a different perspective that isn't just, you know, the same old autopilot volume of information that's out there. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I'm in total agreement. In my opinion, there's several phases to producing even the simplest of program. Number one, put on your thinking cap. You know, get that preparation done. Number two, you know, line up your guests. And number three, actually, you know, do the sell deed. And that there's much more time spent in planning than there is in doing. Yeah, I talk to people often, and yeah, they say, oh, 30 minutes? Oh, I can talk for 30 minutes. Well, no, you can't. not without some planning.
Well, you know what's interesting, and you know, I, and perhaps this is the writer side of me. When you mentioned that, one of the first things that came to mind is the old Art of War book, which says most battles are won or lost long before the fighting begins. Well, it's the same thing with most good or great segments or great shows. It looks easy because the work is done in the background where it isn't seen, where it should be. And most of the effort that goes into a good show is along that particular line, which I talk about in the book, the step-by-step process. And like anything else, it provides a track to run on. But if you do what you should do or need to do in the background, then the show becomes easy, and the guest, it becomes easy. And that's where you get that sort of disarming quality to a show where people are going to start talking. I mean, I can remember talking with Lisa Hacia, who, you know, is a psychologist or counselor to the stars, megastars in Hollywood. Her husband is Lee Aronson, who is the co-creator of shows like Two and a Half Men. And, you know, one of the things we were talking about was the propensity of stars to get into trouble. And the show is focusing on, of course, the difficulties that led to an unfortunate death of Badfinger's lead singer, Pete Ham. And during that same time, ironically, her husband was going through difficulties with the Two and a Half Men. We all know the Charlie Sheen drama that unfolded. And it wasn't my intention to talk about Charlie Sheen per se. I wanted to respect the parameters of, you know, my relationship of talking with her as a guest without, you know, infringing upon ground. But through the natural preparation, she felt comfortable talking and touching on what was going on with Charlie Sheen. And if I hadn't done the preparation for the show, if I hadn't instilled the confidence that, you know, I'm not just looking for a quick soundbite or something that's low-hanging fruit, so to speak, but I actually was interested in the subject matter, you find that guests are more inclined to open up. And the more they open up, the more truthful, the more interesting, the more entertaining the conversation becomes. And I think that's the whole idea of what you alluded to, Simon, is the preparation that goes into it that makes it look easy.
Right. You know, I've been involved with BTR since 2008. I made all of the rookie mistakes. Sure, I can talk for 30 minutes, but I'll tell you what, I learned pretty quick that, 99% of the work goes into what listeners don't hear. You know your subject matter, otherwise you're toast.
Well, and you know what? And what's interesting is those words are wise to not only know the subject matter, otherwise you're toast, absolutely. But I think, you know, and it's a very, very competitive world today. You know, when I grew up, we had the radio, and on TV we had three channels and would get excited when the test pattern came on. Today, listeners, viewers, they have so many options. You know, you have direct TV, satellite TV, you have Sirius XM radio, you have all these things, including Blog Talk Radio, which has thousands and thousands of shows. And so listeners have a very short attention span through which you can not only initially captivate them, but ultimately build a brand loyalty or a following. And that's where that effort comes in, because they can sense when somebody's made the effort to do a quality program. It comes out in the questioning. It comes out in the flow. It comes out in how guests respond. And even the type of guests that you get to the show. There's confidence. I've had a few people, and I've interviewed people from the world of entertainment, but I've also interviewed leading politicians. And quite frankly, the reason they came to the show especially later on as I progressed, is because they saw the quality of what went into the show. And I mean, and there's been some heartfelt stories. There's the extensive coverage I did of the serial suicide killer, William Melker Dinkle, who in Minnesota was actually tried and convicted of talking people into committing suicide over the internet. And what I was fortunate to get was not only somebody like a Pat Brown, who's a criminal profiler that's well known from Nancy Grace, but I actually got the victim's mother, one of the victim's mothers, to come on the show. And there was a confidence there because it wasn't just, how do I get somebody on the show, get it done, get it up, and draw in numbers. There was, there were questions asked. There were things taken in terms of researching this. And I think that shows a respect to the guest. It shows a respect to the listeners. And going back to the point, that will draw listeners into you because they know that you're expending the time and you're delivering something that, they can't get anywhere else, not at least in the same way. You know what I mean?
Right. You're broaching on a really interesting question, and one that I get asked often. For the sake of disclosure, I will admit that I am one of the BTR host trainers. How can I get a guest? And my answer to that is do your research. Send a polite letter, be informative, understand who they are, what they represent. And, it doesn't matter if it's an author, a musician, a politician, but, if your letter, contains meat, you know what you're talking about. Rarely do, or at least in my case, rarely do I get declined.
Well, and you see, it's an interesting point, but that is true. And again, the book talks about how do you structure a letter to approach a guest. And one of the things you hit on is that, these people get contacted all the time. And come on, be on my show. And it's perceived by many of them as, well, and on the surface is, well, how big is your reach? What's your audience? I do a lot of shows. I have busy schedules. But if you do your homework, if you do your research, and in inviting them to be a guest on your show, you highlight some of the points that you've discussed, some of the shows that you've done in the past, it opens up a door of credibility there because they see it as being a different venue. I mean, Chuck Negron, as I alluded to earlier, I came across him on Kickstarter. I had launched and just completed a successful program on Kickstarter for a book that I had ghostwritten. And what was interesting is that I came across his project. And I said, look, I've just completed a project on Kickstarter. I find it interesting here. Here's a little bit of the history. Here's an idea of the flow and format of the show. And he got back to me. And, he's on a tour right now where he's doing six days of one show a night type of thing, and took a 2-3 day hiatus to get home during the July 4th holiday, and then he's on the road again. So his time was at a premium. But if I had just said, hey, come on the show, I'd like to interview you, that wouldn't work. But because there was a point of mutual gain and benefit, and when I say gain and benefit, I'm talking about the fact that he's being new to Kickstarter. Hey, here's somebody who's been on Kickstarter. You put yourself in the shoes of the individual to whom you want to bring on the show, and that's what causes them to really say, okay, it's there. I mean, I've got to tell you, and this was a surprising thing to me, and it still is. I can't believe I still say this, but it is some of the top-notch guests who've been on, Dr. Phil and other shows and everything, some of them have told me that when they go to do an interview, the guest or the host actually sends them an email or a note saying, give me a list of questions you want me to ask you. What? So the guest is being asked to provide the questions that right. They're going to be asked. Well, and it happens more frequently in mainstream media than you'd ever expect. And so, a lot of guests say, wait, here you are, you come in, you've contacted me, then before the show comes, you give me a show outline with a list of the questions that you're going to be asking me. Because I'm not looking for a Mike Wallace 60 Minutes, catch somebody off guard and make them look bad. Nor am I into a fluff piece of infomercial. What I'm into is giving them an opportunity to come on the show and be their best and have those conversations lead to where it naturally will lead. Again, at the Negron interview, when I said, he was not only obviously successful in the music industry, but early in his career, he was actually a vaunted basketball player who had received scholarships to college. And, we all know his story and the challenges he faced with addiction. And I had asked him the question at the first part of the show saying, well, if you had pursued the road less traveled and been a basketball star and moved towards the pro ranks, if you would have, would you have encountered those same challenges with addiction? And his first response was, is the music, and really what he's asking is the music industry, conducive to people running into problems? And his answer at that point was, well, no, I mean, it's not just the music industry, although he had a great story about a Donovan Leitch party and some of the great bands there of how it happened. But, he said, no, the music industry wasn't really conducive to it. And then about, 20 minutes later, 15 minutes later into the interview, I said, well, let me read this 2008 post, and this is where research comes in, or article by an entertainment industry writer who said that, it became clear that Chuck Negron had a propensity for drugs before he got into the music industry. And I said, this is what was written regarding your book, Three Dog Nightmare. And he said, no, I don't agree with that. Propensity, I was a clean-cut guy. I didn't frequent drugs. Yes, there were drugs back then in the sports world. But no, I'd never really been inclined to go into that. And I said, so going back to my earlier question then, if you hadn't gotten into the music industry, are you saying you wouldn't have gone to drugs? And he says, now I see what you're asking. And he says, no, I guess you're right. I wouldn't have probably gotten into drugs had I gone into pursuing an athletic career as opposed to a music career. But had I not done the research to look back and found that, what was considered in today's world an obscure article from 5 years ago, that conversation, that revelation, which is a new revelation for even Chuck, but the listeners and his fans, would have never come out. And that's really where the preparation comes in, and that's upon that's the vehicle upon which you build that credibility so that you attract more guests. That's really the key.
As an aside, Donovan Leitch is one of three musicians that declined to do a program with me. But there again, he hasn't given a sensible interview in something like 30 years. So, I wasn't really surprised.
Well, it's kind of interesting, and you really, again, the story that he had told about his adventure at the party, we can digress a little bit in this, I guess, is that he had never done drugs before, and he had just signed a major record deal, and he was invited to a birthday party, I believe, or a party for Donovan Leitch, and they had, the Mothers of Invention there and all these big-name stars, because as I'm sure doing the interviews that you've done, they all move in similar circles. And he said this beautiful girl came up to him and gave him a kiss and moved the pill from her mouth into his mouth, and that's how it started. So it was at a Donovan Leitch party where he had his first experience with drugs, and he quite frankly talked about the fact that he went from a psychological desire for it to actual a physical dependence on it. But it's a fascinating story. And, you just demonstrated something, Simon, is that as diverse as the world is, there are points of connection or crossover that happen, right?
Absolutely. And, when I first started out, I was concerned. How am I going to snag, interesting guests? But one thing rolls into another. You start out at, I'm going to say the low level, but I don't mean that in a derogatory term. But someone knows someone, and, before you know it, you know, you've got top-notch guests.
You know, it's interesting, and I've got to tell you this, is that, and you know, I know exactly what you mean is low level or whatever, or you know, Kathy Griffith, you know, my life on the D list kind of thing. What's interesting is that your quality of show gets noted by people. It becomes your calling card, and future guests, the best way to get really good guests, not that all guests aren't good, because they all have their story. I mean, thanks to reality TV, Simon, I mean, everyone has the potential to be, you know, a compelling story or a compelling guest. But what happens is your segments become your calling card. They become your introduction into meeting people so that you could, like, for example, back in December, I talked about bullying. And it's a big problem, you know, gaining a lot of major exposure. And through someone that I had done a show with and interviewed and actually co-hosted a show called Love Bites, Rhonda Ricardo, she introduced me to Nordine Zoreg, who is a former two-time Mr. Universe and Mr. World winner. And why? Because he was actually growing up bullied in school. Here he is, a Mr. Universe winner, well-known, you know, a trainer to the stars like Oprah, who was bullied. If I had not done and worked with Rhonda and she had come to respect my work as I do hers, I would have never had that introduction facilitated. It goes to the point that you're talking about. And then, of course, in contacting him, not only do you have the credibility of an introduction, but then you can provide a segment and say, have a listen. You'll get an idea of what the flow of the show is and what it's all about. And, of course, he came and was one of the guests on the show that featured other great people, Jennifer Hancock, Dr. Jack Singer, all these people who have become somewhat regular, semi-regulars on my show. So you have to always bear in mind that every episode, every segment you do, every amount of time you spend is your brand building credibility that opens the doors to introductions, to getting to the A-list guests, to getting those guests who will say, I want to do this show, not because you necessarily have the biggest audience reach, but because you're doing a show that, you know, 1,000 other hosts and interviews I've given haven't done. In other words, I want guests to come away doing it, not only because they want to get out there and reach an audience, but they want to do it because they're doing it for the sheer pleasure of enjoying the conversation.
Okay, there's one element here that sets internet radio, blog talk radio, above terrestrial. And I've done both, right? Terrestrial radio is 2 minutes, it's here and now, and then it's gone. The thing I like about blog talk radio is the fact that the segment is recorded. And that's where I see the value. You know, a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, people can still listen.
That's a huge, huge factor. And I talk about that. In fact, at the beginning of every show, I say, you know, we're broadcasting live over the virtual airwaves of the Blog Talk Radio Network. However, if you can't join us live, not to worry, because the entire program is being recorded so that you can listen on an on-demand basis at your convenience. Simon, I mean, the biggest percentage of listeners I get are on the on-demand version. Sure, I've had shows where I had 800 to 1,000 live listeners. The switchboard lined up with 25, 30 callers. The chat room filled with a ton of people. But at the end of the day, the great power of Blog Talk Radio, just like your PVR on your satellite dish console, is that people can tune in at their convenience. And what's interesting is that there's a timelessness to the number of the shows that you do that I still see some shows that I did 2 years ago that are still getting incredible traction from people. As more and more new listeners come on board, what you build up in your archive or library of on-demand listens then provides them with a new audience or exposure to a new audience And there's always something. Just the other day, and you know, I had Pat Brown again. I mentioned to her earlier. She's a renowned criminal profiler. Again, Nancy Gray.
I have spoken to her. I know exactly.
She's great. And here's the interesting point. About 2 years ago, I did a segment with her on the Boston Strangler. 2 years ago, very popular. Was listened. You know, had its following. Yesterday, news broke about DNA evidence regarding Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler. Well, guess what happened with that show? And, of course, now this is where your marketing eye comes in terms of social media. As soon as I saw that news break, I instantly provided in the comment stream of Pat's discussion on Facebook, and I instantly sent it out there to the virtual realms, into Twitter, and used the Newswire service Sprout, which is ideal for getting messages out conveniently. And, you know, there's an example. Had I not done that show 2 years ago, then when this news broke, there'd be nothing in which you could refer. And the contextual reference point, Simon, was fabulous, because what she said there resonated with the new information that came out today. That's the strength to which you're referring to so adeptly, is that with Blog Talk recording and providing on demand, there is a timelessness to your shows and a continuing relevance for some that 2, 3, 4 years down the road still have an impact.
Absolutely. I get hits on a daily basis on interviews, particularly with authors and musicians that are 4 years old. But the interview is hold on 1 second. Sorry about that. There's some minor disruption in the radio studio, otherwise known as my living room.
See, now you just touched on one of the other advantages of Blog Talk Radio, is that you don't need to have a big studio to have a reach. I mean, some of my broadcasts have come from different parts around the world. I've been at shows where I've done live event feeds from London in the UK, or time-delayed feeds from Sweden where I was giving a lecture on social media. I've also done it from innocuous places, like your own living room, as you're pointing out, along those lines. And the point is that Blog Talk Radio gives you accessibility. So, I've often laughed with my partner Jennifer when, we said, you're talking to a presidential candidate from Haiti, and because it's on the weekend, you're doing it from home in your rec room. that's really the beauty of social media. That's the beauty of citizen journalism, is that it gives everyone an opportunity to be able to be involved, to connect, and I think that's what makes BTR such a great platform, is that it provides the tools for anyone to easily and conveniently take to the airwaves who has a story to share.
The strangest one I have is my wife was bound and determined that we were going to go to a family reunion, I think in Biloxi, and I knew I just had to run a live program, so I did it inside a rather well-appointed camper, armed with a laptop and a cell phone.
So you're an action reporter right there on the front lines.
Exactly. there's a couple of areas that I really want to talk to you about. Your book mentions the green room. You and I both agree on the term. How do you use it? You've got 15 minutes before your program goes on air. You know, what is the most effective way to utilize that time?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because I always say, almost always say to guests, you know, we should have started rolling or taping or broadcasting, whatever term you want to choose, from the virtual green room. Because in the virtual green room, 10 minutes before the show goes live, I'll have the guests call in and we'll just start talking. We'll start talking about, you know, the subject matter that we're going to be covering, asking some questions and getting a feel for it. And it's in that 10 minutes that a couple of very important things happen. Number one, it's like stretching before you go to exercise. It loosens everybody up and everyone's ready to go. So you're not just starting cold from when you know you hit the airwaves. The second point that I found very interesting is that during that time, the guest who has seen or read the questions or the show outline has started to think about answers already and starting to think. And when I talk with them there, a lot of things come out about their perceptions about the questions and highlights in areas that I might not otherwise have thought. I mean, I can't count the number of times something that was said in the virtual green room has found its way into the discussion that I wouldn't have otherwise have known, even with great research. And so I think what's really interesting is it's a place where you get set, you get relaxed, you get ready to start, and then when you hit the airways, you're ready to roll. You're already smoking, so to speak, not literally, figuratively, of course, but also it's the fact that it also reveals a certain thing of in terms of the guest's mind space, their thinking, some of the thoughts they have with what you're going to be asking them, and that can really have a positive influence relative to how the tempo of the show goes.
You know, I agree with you 100%. The last thing in the world I want is a yes-no guest, that they don't know where I'm going and that they don't want to open mouth and insert foot. So whatever question you ask, you get the answer yes, no. But I like the green room. It's a way that you can decompress someone. And some of the guests I have, like yourself, you know, really don't need that decompression time. But many guests have never been on radio before and they're nervous. So, you know, a couple of minutes of general chat and, you know, lead them through the areas that you're planning on talking about. Suddenly, they're no longer yes-no guests. That's the way I use it.
I think that that's really the key part of things because, you know, even those who, you know, interestingly enough, those who may not have been interviewed previously, but even those who've been interviewed so many times, one of the things that happened is that if you've done 500 interviews and you're talking about the same book, you're talking about the same subject, you know, eventually the guests themselves can fall into a rut or autopilot response where, okay, here's the answer. Even when they're not doing yes or no, it can be the equivalent of yes or no answers if it's the same thing. Because let's face it, they're not enthused because it's the same track they've always run. The listeners, of course, other than your core fan base, and remember, in terms of audience speak and reach, you have your core fans that'll listen to anything that you do because they just happen to like you, your brand. And then your much larger audience base, and this is where you build and expand your core from where you expand them, is those listeners who are going to tune in because of the subject matter. Well, if they've tuned in to you because of the subject matter, chances are they've listened to other interviews around the same subject matter. So if you're just merely doing a perfunctory Q&A, even if the answers are longer than yes or no, they're not going to stay tuned in. And that's where, going back again, where it all ties in, Simon, is the research and getting the green room set up. So that green room, just to focus on the immediate issue or topic, is that the green room gives that guest, even the seasoned one, that chance to say, wait a second, you know, I've got these questions. I never had this before. But talking with this individual, I'm really getting enthused. I'm really getting energized. And then that's really, I think, where it benefits those who are much more seasoned. But that's really, I think, really the key part of it is that, you know, doing your homework, using the green room, it builds that credibility and creates that unique experience that hopefully makes your broadcast, your show, stand out from everyone else's.
Yes, and I absolutely agree with you. My next question, again, I've played both sides of this. I'm going to have program, and the question is to script or not to script. My theory is scripts get derailed within the first 30 seconds. First question you ask, your script is out of the window. My personal theory is I have a list of notes, bullet points of areas I want to talk about, and maybe I will write a paragraph to describe the question. That's my script. Is that the way you work?
Well, you know, what's funny is it's an interesting point, because when one hears the word script, one assumes it's been positioned or it's been like an infomercial where, you know, there's a clear track. And these are the words that you're saying. In essence, when I do a format of the show, I'll provide them with the opening comments. I'll be reading what I'll say about BTR, bring them on as a guest, and then I'll provide three different segments of questions in which each segment has a heading as to what the main focus is. What's interesting about this, and it's almost like those who are in business who've done PowerPoint presentations will appreciate this. If you do a PowerPoint and you read the slides as opposed to referencing the slides, that's when it becomes cardboardy. That's when it becomes sort of like rehearsed and becomes the traditional definition of a script. I'm reading this. What you look at is, instead of like the slides in a PowerPoint, your show outline is a track to run on that gives you the questions of what you can expect. But if you have done your research and you're listening and you're involved in the discussion, as you ask those questions, they'll open up the door, if they've been well researched, to five other questions that aren't on the list. And you have, and that's where you, as a host, manage the flow of the show. I mean, there has been discussions where, you know, I've listed questions that have been inspired to create new avenues of discussion. So it's not like, okay, I'm going to ask you this question. You have to give me an answer specifically to this question, and then I'm going to go to question number two and ask you that specifically. The questions are more a track or a touchstone that is used to stimulate greater and broader discussion. So it comes out, you know, and again, I'll use that example of my interview with Chuck Negron. You know, the question was asked, did it, you know, your entry into the music world cause you to do drugs if you'd gone another route where you might not have? And, you know, the answer to the question was, well, no, I don't think so. You know, it's you know, music industry has its own ups and downs and toughness. But then there was that other question going in the next segment saying, as I alluded to earlier, well, what about this article? The whole idea of it is that the questions are designed to stimulate conversation. They're touch points. They are not absolutes. And just like the PowerPoint script, they're a reference point. But the discussion must, to be good, take on a life of its own. Now, one of the questions that people ask, especially those who may be new to hosting, is, well, won't that get me off track? Won't that get me going down avenues and roads of discussion that have nothing to do with what the original show's focus is? The answer is no, not necessarily, if you have a firm understanding as to what your research is and why you have that question in there in the first place. You're not looking for an answer and it's over. It's part of a cascading or compounding each question discussion that opens up more insight. And you have to be able to, well, keeping your touchstone reference point, have to be able to open yourself up to avenues of disclosure or comments that may not otherwise have occurred. And if the show then does start to go off in too much of a tangent, so to speak, or attraction, you have that line of focus that you're saying, this is the purpose of why I asked these questions in the first place. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, that's the reason that, you know, I just have some bullet points. Yeah, I'll ask them the question. I'm often looking at the time clock, the countdown, and when I see that the program's getting derailed, I'll put it back on track. Getting derailed is easy, but if you've got some notes, you can always put it back on track.
Yeah, and that's really a key. But that goes back. You see how everything's interconnected? It's kind of interesting because you raise a good point. You get back on track because you've done the research, because the questions you've set and the points of reference and their talking points, let's call them that, talking points, are there to inspire the guest to open up. And you don't know, and many times, Simon, the guests themselves don't know or expect to open up the way that they do. Yet they do, and that's where these talking points come in, because you've caused them to think of something in an entirely different way. And that's how it all ties in together. It becomes a catalyst for open and honest discussions. And some of the best conversations you have, and I liken it to going to the local coffee shop and sitting down and talking with someone. And the audience, I once referred to as being welcomed eavesdroppers from other table listening in, is that you don't take notes or hard notes and have a script to follow. What you have are these reference points in your head, but certainly when you put them on paper, they give you that track and help the guests to know where you're going. But the key is that you want to ultimately stimulate conversation and involvement with the guest that literally enhances the conversation and takes in new directions, and then the audience gets involved and they start to like it. And going back to expanding your audience base, is that if you display or demonstrate this kind of tendency of being able to engage, then they'll tune in the next time. Even if it may not be a subject matter that they may not have been interested in, or a guest for whom they may never listen to before, they'll tune in on that basis because they will. They'll like the fact that, hey, there's something that's going to come out of this that may not come out anywhere else. And I think that's really the key.
One of the questions I get asked frequently is, you know, how can I, as a host, increase the listenership? Now, you touched on it earlier, social media, Facebook, Twitter. Give me your thoughts on what a host really should do.
You have to, I call it the three C's, content, context, contact. And what I talk about that is we talk about content, the key of the quality of the content that you have, the perspectives that you bring. But you create the real-world context for it. And again, using the Boston Strangler example, you have to always be tied into what's going on in the world around you. You always have to have this interest for everything that's out there. And so when that news broke of the Boston Strangler story, you insert yourself into the content, into the conversation, because that's provided the context of a real-world here-and-now reference point. And that's really the key. And you gain the contact by, again, sharing that on the Facebooks, comments within, like, for example, the Washington Post, New York Times, CBS Pittsburgh, when I covered the Penn State Nittany Lions scandal. You know, what I did is I got involved in their conversations, gave my opinions with link backs to my shows and my blog posts relating to the shows. And that drew tremendous traffic. You know, there was a Kony 2012 video that had come out. And what was interesting about that was the fact that, you know, everyone's talking about we got to hunt down this Kony, we got to do this, we got to do that. And of course, I had researched the story and, you know, discovered that it had everything that was on the surface. Yes, this was a despicable tyrant and whatever, but everything on the surface of what made him bad, it was similar to what Noriega was and what Saddam Hussein was. In other words, he had outlived his usefulness to the powers that be, and now he was being offered up as a sacrificial lamb because he was now getting in the way of what they wanted to get in the original intent of their relationship. So I wrote this post relating to the show, and the Daily Telegraph picked it up, and within like an hour I had 1,200 downloads of a blog post that I had written. In other words, I looked at it and said the content and the quality of the research was there. Then I looked for the real world context of what was happening. And you'd be surprised how lucky you can be in being at the right place at the right time if you've done your homework. What was it that the old saying is chance favors the prepared mind? Well, you're prepared. Okay, so you position yourself, and then you're following what happens. Then when you've got the contextual reference points, that's when you do make the contact with the readership. A lot of hosts believe that if I go on Facebook, for example, and I set up an event, and I broadcast that I'm doing a show, that's going to draw a lot of listeners. And they spend a lot of time and a lot of cycle inviting guests, just like likes. You know, I'm dubious about likes. I'm not sure that likes really indicate much. But nonetheless, they're nice to have. But in reality, you're just doing broadcasting. All you're doing is another form of broadcasting, just leveraging social media to talk out at people. What I talk about is conversational engagement, making yourself part of the conversation, the community. You insert yourself into the common streams of the major media and tie with links. And they allow link backs if you have something good to say, not if you're spamming or just say, hey, come and listen to me and have nothing to do with it. If you provide an interesting point of contact or reference of what your opinion is and a link back, the New York Times and the Washington Post will allow you to put your links up, and they get a lot of traffic that ends up spilling over to you. And I provide you with a link, I think, Simon, to an article I wrote about that.
Right.
So when you leverage, well, that's it. So when you leverage social media, you're not just talking at people. What you're doing is you're creating quality content and then waiting. Position yourself for the opportunity of creating or finding a contextual open point based upon a hot news story today. And then when you find that contextual point of entry, that's when you go out into the social media world and you have something to say that people can relate to.
Right. Oh, that makes perfect sense to me. The problem I have with Twitter and Facebook is you seem to be talking to people you already know. I think that there are ways to grow listeners outside of social media, particularly through, you know, a blog or a website. But is, you know, that idea, you know, in keeping with your own?
Absolutely. Blogs are so critical. And you see, this is the point. Blogs require discipline. And that is, you have to do 2 to 4 posts every week on a blog. And, you know, it's interesting, but when I first started the first blog back in 2007, I got into blogging more as a convenience because I would write articles for traditional, media, magazines, hard copy, as well as some of the electronic print versions. And the trouble is I was always dealing with editors and different timelines and different deadlines and all of these factors. And so when I looked, somebody said, why don't you do a blog? And the great part is you can write whatever you want, put it out there, and like a buffet, you can let the editors know, and they will come to you. And yet, you know, you've already written something. And I looked at that and said, what a great convenience. Instead of multiple deadlines juggling in the air and different publications contacting me, why not just create a central repository, which is what I viewed a blog originally as. And I love writing. I write now for a handful of blogs, some for clients who hire me to write their blogs, as well as books. I love writing. And so I thought, what a great way to do this, because I can then write about things that I know and move me and about which I'm passionate that will have an interest. And if it doesn't have an interest, I'll build my own audience. And, of course, I've sold sponsorships for the blogs that have gone very, very well. So the blogs is a complementary medium to the LinkedIn groups, for example, or the Facebook pages or the Twitters. Those are all interconnected. And, again, the whole idea comes down to that content, context, contact model, because the content is still the most critical element of it, and having a contextual relevance is still, regardless of the medium you're on. I mean, you know, I have traditional medium who follows some of my blog, and I'm oftentimes, or in certain instances where I'm quoted in the mainline media and newspapers for some of the coverage I'm doing. And that's great stuff, by the way. But it's the medium isn't the message. Marshall McLuhan, to a certain degree, is right, but it isn't the medium. It's how you leverage and utilize the medium in terms of a service attitude of what you're delivering out to somebody. You know, and that's what really is the key mindset you have to bring to all of this. And a blog serves as such an important cornerstone of building that brand, because it's your personal rapport with your audience. It's their time to comment with you. It's their time to read about what you have to say. And then you have everything else, touch points, or the cross-pollination factor to which I refer, that becomes so key. And that is the real measurement of influence. It's not how many, you know, they used to measure things like number of hits you get on a site. Number of hits are like likes. They don't necessarily indicate that you have really any reach or influence with your audience. What does demonstrate that is that the level of engagement and the scope of which you're known, and it, that opens up the door to the opportunities.
Okay. I'm going to do some shameless, absolutely shameless commercialization. Where can people find copies of your book? Your show will go live in 5 seconds.
Well, it's in multiple places. You can get it on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and, of course, Lulu. And all you have to do, interestingly enough, is type in one of two things. Your show will go live in 5 seconds. You can also do a Google search and type in PI Window. And we occupy and dominate the first page on that, or just type in my name. But, yeah, you get through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and through Lulu. But just type in PI Window, PI Window on the World, PI Window on Business, and we will automatically come up, and I'll have all the links.
Do you have a website, you know, blog, that kind of thing?
Oh, you know what? The best website to go to is www.pisocialmedia1.com. That's one word.
Okay. Now, going back to the plot, one of the questions that I get asked by hosts a lot is, how can I make money off my broadcast? I have my theory. I'd love to hear yours.
Well, you know what? And again, it's a very basic approach. And I'll give it straight up. There's no secret to it. When I first launched the Procurement Insights blog, because remember, the blog is tied intimately to the radio show. When I first launched that, I charged a nominal $250 a year to corporate sponsors. And within a very short time, I had 40, 50 sponsors. And from there, when I extended the radio, they would then pay to extend their sponsorship. And I had a similarly priced package ranging anywhere from $250 to $2,500. So in essence, where they could have a placement on a banner, where they'd have reference in the rotating boxes of the show page in and of itself. So your first level of revenue in and of itself is going to be in the realm of a complimentary blog with the Blog Talk radio site, because people will be inclined to sponsor a blog. They then become your BTR site sponsor. And I find that the blog entry point to selling sponsorships on BTR are the best ways to go. So that's how I did it. Now, that laid a foundation for a revenue stream, because once these corporate sponsors came on, where you want to go, the majority of Blog Talk Radio people are not what you would call like the traditional media people, where they're looking at building huge advertising, right? Well, I'm sure everyone is, but building huge advertising revenues based on a listener base. Because let's face it, most of the hosts in Blog Talk Radio are relatively new to the medium. Most of them are trying to use it as a way to enhance their brand or existing business. There's obviously a passion for radio, but it's a medium for connecting with your audience in a unique way. So, you know, the key part of it is that most of the hosts will have a business that they're trying to, or a service, whether it be consulting or whatever else, that they're trying to promote. And that's where this added benefit comes in, because having the mediums of a blog and a Blog Talk Radio gives me an opportunity to land sponsors. Out of those sponsors, number of them have grown into $50,000, $75,000 a year clients. And that's where the step-by-step process follows, is that the sponsorship of the blog and the Blog Talk Radio show and the sponsorships that you do relating to that create the social media presence that helps you to build a distinguishable brand relating to the core services that you are offering. And as a result, you then are able to have opportunities to build and land new clients that will augment your existing revenue stream. So, like, for example, I'd bring on a sponsor for $250 on the blog, then they'd pay another $500 to be on the radio. Then they'd want a white paper written, and I'd charge them $2,500 to $3,000 for a white paper. Then they'd want a book written, so you charge $30,000 for a book to be written. Then they'd want to have you expand their social media presence. Do you see how it all connects? But it all starts, much like the acorn of the mighty oak, it all starts from the point of opening doors of communication with potential sponsors. And if you don't have a blog and you don't have Blog Talk Radio, how else are you going to connect with sponsors?
Right. And we're running short on time, but I did some fiddling behind the scenes, so we still have our live listeners. How about the importance of regularity? And I'm not talking about eating fiber, but
right.
You know, having a program on the same day and time each week, is that important?
Right out of the gate, listen, when I first started, Simon, I had every Thursday at 12 noon Eastern Standard Time, 30 minutes. The reason I chose 30 minutes is that, again, being new to the medium, I wanted to make sure that I had enough time so that there'd be a meaningful discussion, but not so much time that, you know, you just wouldn't have the staying power. It's like writing a newsletter is the best way to say it, is that with the newsletter, people start off launching that. They do the first issue. It's great. Then they got to do the second one. Then they got to do and next thing you know, and it's like blogging. Next thing you know, it becomes a chore to start doing that. So the key is when you start to have that time slot of consistent, I'm here for this long, for this much. And I ran that time slot for about a year and a half. Then as I began to expand and more listeners came on board and more client reach became a factor, and clients started to want to produce a show or sponsor me to host a roundtable on air. Then you became more flexible with that particular time. So that, you know, for example, today, when I do my broadcast, you know, they'll usually happen on a Tuesday or a Friday. That's me doing the shows that I like, again, the Chuck Negron or the upcoming Five Alive, Real Women of Five Alive. Then I have the regular shows of which I produce and provide some commentary, such as Buyer's Meeting Point, which has a Monday at 12 noon, every Monday at 12 noon, talking about events from the world of procurement, and Dr. Jack Singer, Psychologically Speaking, every Thursday at 12 noon. So, you know, in terms of as it's expanded, it's important that you first and foremost always start off with a regular time slot on the same day so people can find you. As you begin to expand, you can have a little bit more latitude, and you're going to have some segments, as I alluded to, that are going to appear at the same day, at the same time, all the time, and then you have a little bit of flexibility on your own time of Tuesdays or Fridays because you've already built an audience who is looking for you.
Right. Plan B. Now, I don't know how many hundreds of programs I've done. Most guests turn up on time and you're good to go. The problem children I've found are musicians. That they seem to be time challenged. What's your idea on a plan B? You're 2 minutes from going live. There's no sign of the guest. What do you do?
Okay, well, there's a couple of things. First of all, prevention is the best medicine. One of the reasons why I like sending out the show outline with the questions is it reaffirms in the guests and reconfirms with them why they want to be on the show itself. About 20 minutes before the show and leading up until when they actually do call in, I send them a reminder email with the call-in number again, which makes a big difference as well. So, ironically, I don't believe in all the shows I've done where I haven't had a guest who hasn't shown up. Now, that doesn't mean I haven't run into some technical problems or technical difficulties where, for example, a guest, you know, when I was interviewing Dr. Eddie DeLalu, who was calling in by cell phone, satellite cell phone from Haiti, you know, in you know what happened with their infrastructure with the earthquake, we had some connection problems at the very beginning. So what I do always are two things. One, I have some musical interludes and guest soundbite, previous show soundbites that run a variety of time. So that if I have to and say, look, you know, we've run into some technical difficulties with bringing on our guest today, we're just going to take a couple of minutes to be able to get it all worked out. In the meantime, why don't you enjoy this latest hit from so-and-so, Sarah McClurg, you know, recent winner of the Music Indie Award, Country Artist of the Year, Tennessee Rain. And so I'll play that, and I'll give you 2 to 4 minutes. If it looks like the problem can't be solved, then what happens is I always have a backup full episode of one of the top favorites. You know, and you know, when you do 650 of these things, you usually notice there's two or three that continually attract an audience. So I'm already ready with alternative programming on the side. So those things always come in handy in terms of being there. Or to say it another way, like the old analogy, it's better to have an umbrella and not need one than to need one and not have one. It's better to have plans in place to do this. And it's also the same, Simon, I might add, with utilizing landlines and even on Skype. You know, one of the things that's very, very interesting is Skype is convenient. You don't want to necessarily call in using a wireless connection because there can be some difficulties in quality. But, you know, the other day, you know, I was actually doing it from a landline, and rarity of rarities, the landline went dead. I was able to use Skype just at the end of the show, but because I have this contingency plan already drafted out, it's like a checklist for an airline pilot. I said, okay, if phone goes out, I went on Skype. Even though I was wireless and the quality might have been questionable, because it was after the show, what I could do is close off, make one brief comment where the quality came through, and then still access the switchboard to kick into the closing music. So what you do is you plan for contingencies so that if they do happen, you go on autopilot and you know what needs to be done. And then, of course, there's the fun part where I've done shows where once I spilled an entire can of Coke all over my keyboard in my lap, and the keyboard shorted out, you know. But again, you have these kinds of contingencies, and that goes back to what I said at the top of our interview, Simon, is that Blog Talk Radio, one of their greatest benefits is that they are such an intuitive, user-friendly medium or platform that you don't have to have a lot of expertise or technical know-how to broadcast a show. And if something does happen, you can usually very, very quickly, have an alternative means so that you don't skip a beat. And that's important, by the way, because I'm sure, as you'll attest, 5 seconds of dead air seems like 5 hours when you're experiencing it, but it's not really. And of course, on the side with Blog Talk Radio, if you're a premium host, for example, you have live chat and call-in, so you've always got somebody there. So overall, if you have these if you expect contingencies to happen, you plan for it. And one of the reasons why I wrote the book is I didn't want people who are coming for the first time to have to learn the hard way that you and I, for example, had to. Is if you have the contingency plans in place and you're prepared, you'll skip a beat. You won't skip a beat, and the audience won't notice that you have a problem. And that's the best testimony to being prepared.
Oh, absolutely. You know, rule number one, have plan B, C, and D. You know,
that's exactly it. And again, that goes back to the whole reason I wrote the book is that, and you had mentioned it yourself when you came on board, is that, and started broadcasting, is you learned and I won't say the hard way, but you learned by baptism of fire. And the learning curve, albeit short with Blog Talk Radio, they're still there. So I thought if I wrote the book and help people to structure a show, promote the show, manage a show, if there's a problem, how to handle the switchboard with an unruly guest, all of these things, I thought if I put in one easy-to-read format and reference-wise, that they would get a much more enjoyable experience that much sooner.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I went through my trial by fire. And I can't say it was enjoyable at the time, but you learn really quick.
And just think, they make very colorful and entertaining stories.
Oh, they do indeed. John, we're almost flat out of time. I do want to thank you for taking time out to talk to me today. Do you have any parting thoughts for us?
Well, I think like anything else, Blog Talk Radio, and that's what we're really talking about today, provides a unique and what I consider to be an unprecedented opportunity for you to get out there and connect with people. I mean, talking with one of their senior people, they said whether or not you have a knitting circle group of 8 or 9 to talk on the radio, or you're trying to reach millions, the fact remains is the format, and they have a package for you. And I love the medium of talk radio. I think there is something to it that goes beyond what you can see, digital TV, internet TV, and all of those, and I've done a lot of those mediums, that there's something I cherish about what they've provided. And the great hosting and listener experience is something very much worthwhile. So if you're thinking of getting into Blog Talk Radio and listening to today's show, there are obviously numerous, numerous advantages to doing that. Hopefully listening to us today has encouraged you to do that, and that you become part of a host fraternity, for lack of a better word, where you're never really alone. So that's really the parting word, Simon.
Perfect. Yeah, I run some computers that have Microsoft products. And you know what? When I have a problem, no one wants to help me. But One thing that I discovered early on with Blog Talk Radio is if you've got a question, people answer quickly. I like that.
Well, because that's a key point there, is that not only are you not alone, but that the support mechanisms that are set up and the way in which the people at Blog Talk Radio care, they get back to you. You matter to them. Whether you have a show that reaches 50 people or 50 million, the level of support and the level of guidance you get from the people at Blog Talk Radio makes the experience an enjoyable one, makes it one that you can focus upon why you got on the airwaves to begin with. And that's the key. So I think that's wise words you said there, Simon.
Okay. All right. Need to wrap this up. John, again, thank you so much for spending time with me. It's been a delightful discussion, and I enjoyed your book a great deal, even though I was just revisiting in many ways my own journey. It's nice to be able to say that, hell, you know, someone else has taken this journey.
Well, that you know what, Simon, I thank you for having me on the show because, again, when you write a book, and as any writer will say, is that if what you write, if what you put together connects with the reader, even one reader, then it's worth the effort. And so I appreciate that, and I appreciate the fact that somebody who has such experience has found enjoyment and useful insights from the book because, you know, that's really the highest compliment any writer can get.
And John, till next time, and I'm sure we will talk again at some point, I want to wish you a happy, healthy, and safe day, and we will talk again sometime. Till then, goodbye.
Thank you, Simon.